Sociologists like Mills and Weber would observe that it is precisely such human interaction that more deeply integrates the group, turning it from a random gathering of peers into something more. Human interaction allows for a community of interests that is capable, through shared knowledge and relationships, of managing itself and coordinating subsets of the group to advance desired goals. When pressed on this, Coelho is a little uncomfortable. Perhaps he hesitates because he is on several boards and committees associated with the forum and wants to diffuse the critiques of the anti-globalists and the conspiracy theorists. As a true Davos insider, he wants to suggest that there really is no system, but merely individuals connecting with one another. Coelho argues that, as a humanist, he sees beyond the facade of systems and into a world of typical relationships, much like any others. He offers, as an example, the story of meeting Bill Clinton during the last year of his presidency. Coelho was invited as one among 20 to meet the president, and he arrived at the designated time to a conference room where he stood alone on the periphery of a crowd of seemingly important people. The people were, in fact, so important that the system should have kept him, just a writer from Brazil, out of such a gathering altogether. He felt humiliated at being so ignored and out of place. But when Clinton entered the room, he asked, "Which of you is Paulo Coelho?" As Coelho described it, he said, "It's me, Mr. President." And then everybody looked at me, and they looked, and I smiled, and I suddenly became a friend of all of them, you know? And Clinton came to me and said, "Hello, how are you? I really wanted to meet you because I read your book. My daughter forced me to read it." And then we started talking about the most surrealistic things, about jet lag and things like that, and people all around us are just waiting to talk about this system, and how they were going to control it, and what is the next step, Mr. President, and bah, bah, bah. But they end up standing there listening to me and Clinton talk about jet lag, and afterwards they treated me completely differently. I was in with them. He offers the story to illustrate the looseness of the system, and certainly it is a revealing snippet about how this elite differs from past aristocratic elites. Here was a Brazilian and former hippie songwriter who had failed in an attempt to join the priesthood, meeting the son of a broken, lower-middle-class Arkansas home. Two individuals thrown together by their accomplishments at the pinnacle of the world, with a bond and a common language, with influence over one another and over countless millions beyond them. But, in fact, the story also illustrates the compounding impact of elite interaction, recalling the famous story of the young man who comes in the 19th century to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to meet with J.P. Morgan to ask him for a loan. Morgan ponders the request and then says, "Let me offer you something equally valuable." And he puts his arm around the fellow and walks him around the exchange floor, chatting with him, thereby sending the message that the young man was well connected. The point being that the very fact of the existence of status creates a system whereby those who have status can transfer it to those around them and determine who is elevated and who is not. Power can be meted out by choice. Coelho's conversation moved a bit like wind across a bay, shifting with the passing clouds and the time of day. He sipped his coffee and then offered another story. He enjoys archery, he said, and often practices in a hilly area not too far from his house in the French countryside. One day, while practicing, he was approached by a soldier who was passing through from a nearby military base. The soldier smiled when he learned who Coelho was, and proceeded to tell the famously inspirational author about a recent experience he had speaking at a local school. "I went to talk to a group of students," he said, "and I decided to ask them what they wanted to learn about. So they made a list of questions, and to be honest, I don't know how to answer those questions, and that is why I am so glad I have run into you up here on this hill. Perhaps you can help me." Coelho, curious, offered to help and asked what the questions were. The officer replied, "Is there a God? What happens after we die? Is there life outside the planet Earth? Why do people hate each other? Things like this. Philosophical questions that you have as a child and that we still have as adults. Coelho's point, he explained, was this. We want to believe in a system. We want to believe in higher powers. Chaos and randomness make life too threatening, too hard to understand, too easy to see as meaningless. So, as human beings, we seek order in the universe. As he spoke, I heard more resonances with what Mills wrote as he pondered why people viewed the question of the existence of elites in different ways. The view that all is blind drift is largely a fatalist projection of one's own feeling of impotence, and perhaps, if one has ever been active politically in a principled way, a salve of one's guilt. The view that all of history is due to the conspiracy of an easily located set of villains, or of heroes, is also a hurried projection from the difficult effort to understand how shifts in the structure of society open opportunities to various elites, and how various elites take advantage or fail to take advantage of them. To accept either view, of all history as conspiracy or of all history as drift, is to relax the effort to understand the facts of power and the ways of power. For many, like Coelho, order comes from a belief in God and a divine plan. Others, because they are uncertain about supernatural higher powers, or because they seek to supplement them, find some comfort in the idea that someone is in charge here on this earth. Indeed, we accept power in others because it brings order with it, suggests that we are not random clouds of subatomic particles appearing and bouncing off of one another and disappearing without rhyme or reason. In times of great change and uncertainty, such as the epical transformation we are now experiencing as we enter the global era, there is an even greater need to seek out such order. This fundamental need has benefited ambitious individuals throughout human history, as they have translated it into acceptance of their power in the name of providing order and leadership. As the meeting with Coelho ended, the president of Brazil walked by and warmly greeted his country's most famous writer. We all chatted briefly, and in the context of that room and of Davos at large, the conversation attracted little attention because so many similar to it were happening everywhere. As I stood there in our little corner of this very modest hotel, in this otherwise very ordinary corner of Switzerland, it was difficult not to feel that this community of leaders truly was part of something exceptionally important and different in the history of the world. Its emergence represented a watershed in how power was distributed among individuals and among nations, and it was vital to understand because it was directly connected to the fate of every man and woman on the planet. Vilified by some, feared by others, only vaguely comprehended even by its members, around me were members of a new elite that surpassed in power, resources, and especially global influence, all those other elites, all the kings and emperors and titans of industry who had come before them. They are the superclass, the global power elite that is reshaping the planet. The purpose of this book is to attempt to better understand them, their influence, the trends that are shaping them, and the consequences of their existence for us all. Chapter 1. Each one is one in a million. Meet the superclass. We are all worms, but I do believe that I am a glowworm. Winston Churchill. They call them green planes. They get the name not because they are more environmentally friendly or because they are new and untested. They actually are green, a pale lemon-lime color, yet to be painted or fitted out to the final specifications of their future owners. On any given day, there are four or five of them positioned in two rows, nose to tail, in the main assembly facility at Gulfstream Aerospace's headquarters in Savannah, Georgia. As I walk through the cavernous hangar with Brian Moss, at the time Gulfstream's president, there is no mistaking the pride of the workers. Gulfstream employs 5,000 people in Georgia, most of them in its main facilities near Savannah's International Airport. As we pass by, workers pause from riveting or installing the miles of wiring that run through Gulfstream aircraft to joke with Moss or smile and wave. Some are especially enthusiastic as they mistake me for the owner of a NASCAR racing team, Rick Hendrick of Hendrick Motorsports, who is due to visit later the same afternoon. Gulfstream, a division of U.S. defense contractor General Dynamics, specializes in private jet aircraft. It offers a line of planes ranging from the mid-sized G-150 and G-200 to the gold standard of corporate jets, the G-500 and G-550. The G-550 can travel almost 7,000 nautical miles, the distance from New York to Tokyo, transporting 8 passengers in the lap of luxury, reclining leather lounge chairs, polished wood paneling, a well-equipped galley and bar, high-tech entertainment and communication systems, and one or more convertible beds. The price tag for such opulence? Typically over $45 million. But the 80 or so individuals and organizations that purchase Gulfstream aircraft this year will not simply be buying the Rolls-Royce of general aviation. As it happens, one of the G5s I walk through during my visit is destined for use by the senior management of the Rolls-Royce company. These clients are increasingly looking for something more security, more privacy, more flexibility in their travel schedules, and a more efficient return on their investment of the time every trip takes. Perhaps they are lured by the advanced avionics that give Gulfstream pilots more tools, more information, more technology at their disposal than the pilots of the most advanced commercial aircraft. For example, the new aircraft typically come equipped with the Gulfstream Enhanced Vision System, which provides pilots with the ability to see in low visibility and night conditions by superimposing symbols and infrared imagery on top of the images the pilots see optically. Soon these will be supplanted by systems that actually offer synthetic vision, essentially a system that fills in what you can't see with what a computer knows to be there, mountains, for example, or radio towers or runways. That's not the kind of luxury that the general public imagines when they think of CEOs and celebrities racing from one corner of the globe to another at 41,000, being served scones with clotted cream or freshly prepared sushi platters. But in a world where commercial aviation is fraught with stress and delays and a host of security risks, more and more of those who can afford the private aircraft option are seeing it not as a self-indulgent luxury, but as a risk management tool, a necessity of the global era. As Moss says, we serve a very, very narrow portion of the people on this planet. They have very specific needs. They require certain capabilities. And for them to do the things they believe they need to do, to go to the places they need to go, to see the people they need to see, to make those decisions that influence how investments are made at the time and in the place they need to, that group of people focuses more and more on productivity and global mobility, and that's what we're all about. As he speaks, one of the senior workers on the production line, a tall, older man in a white shirt and goggles, emerges from the tail section of an aircraft and comes over to shake Moss's hand and discuss the production schedule. Others join in and the chat is focused and friendly. There is no question that the blue-collar workers of Savannah, Georgia, don't resent the success of Gulfstream. They build aircraft that roll out of the factory and literally ascend to a level of society that they will never enjoy. But they do it with evident pride and perhaps a sense that they are the beneficiaries of globalization, proving the quality of American workers and enabling them to enjoy the considerable down-home benefits of middle-class life in the American South. Another worker, a short woman with an unmistakable Georgia accent, comes over to tell Moss how thrilled she was to have won 2 tickets to a NASCAR race from the company. As NASCAR has become America's biggest spectator sport, and as many of its drivers and their corporate sponsors have become Gulfstream owners, the aircraft manufacturer has devoted more and more time to becoming part of that world, a world that has long been a part of the lives of the workers who make the planes themselves. The woman from the assembly line and Moss joke about the race car event, and then she and the other workers who had gathered around us return to their duties. Moss and I head to a large hangar space where two G450s and two G550s are being completed, now recognizable as finished aircraft, with long, graceful lines, large oval windows, and upswept winglets. There is no symbol in the world of today's global elite that can surpass the Gulfstream jet. Only 1,500 are in service. Only the most privileged can possess them or enjoy the benefits they offer. 80% of those sold go to leading corporations that can afford what Moss estimates as the $1.25 to $1.5 million that it costs to maintain an aircraft for 500 hours a year of service. Only 5% are sold to individuals, with the rest going to government leaders and special missions, such as providing planes for military transport or medical evacuation purposes. Internally, Gulfstream considers the threshold for real sales prospects to be a company with annual revenues in excess of $1 billion or an individual with financial assets in excess of $25 million. But most owners easily surpass those projected barriers to ownership. When the standard private jet isn't enough, there is a modest but growing number of superjets in service, larger passenger aircraft like the Boeing 737 and Airbus 320 that have been converted from commercial transport to private use. Even bigger models are entering the market, like the used 767 that Google's bargain-hunting Larry Page and Sergey Brin bought for only $15 million. Now Boeing has begun booking orders for private versions of its new wide-body 787, the Dreamliner, and for the next iteration of the 747, the 8 Series. Airbus, too, has done a small amount of business in super high-end private aircraft. Notably, the custom versions of the double-decker Airbus 380, purchased by mostly Middle Eastern clients for personal use. Each of these mammoth aircraft cost $300 million as its base price, plus another $100 million or more for the customizations. These megajets are anomalies in the private jet world, however, conjured up by some seeming glandular malfunction in the part of the brain that calibrates ambition to fantasy. Certainly some of these jets are for heads of state who require secure transport wherever and whenever diplomatic duty calls, but many are also home to game rooms, multiple dining areas, and even whirlpool bathtubs. When it comes to the most over-the-top jets, of course, it's not about need. Or perhaps more accurately, it is about a different kind of need, one born not of necessity but of compulsion. Perfectly rational individuals, successful beyond imagination, grow very animated when they discuss the rationale for having their G5 fitted out not in Savannah, better for purely corporate needs, but rather in Long Beach, California, reputedly better for the special needs of rich individuals. They speak knowingly of where to find a particular cappuccino maker, advanced entertainment system, or special upholstery for the jet's interior. For some, these planes are the metrics of a lifetime. While most of us may measure our lives, like J. Alfred Prufrock, in coffee spoons, there are a few who measure them in high-performance aircraft that can fly them from Hong Kong to Cape Town in 12 hours. The most extreme forms of private aviation excess, however, are the exception to the rule at Gulfstream, which typically views the task of customization much as does a Savile Row tailor. The majority of these aircraft are bespoke, but subtly. Typically so subtly that even their distinctive liveries, the patterns in which their exteriors are painted, vary only slightly. Perhaps the difference, say, between the gray pinstripe suit in a banker's wardrobe and the navy blue. As Moss says, sometimes an individual will bring in an outside designer to work with them, and they'll end up with a particular piece of art, or a lamp, or something like that in the airplane. But for us, there really isn't any squirrely stuff anymore. CEOs, wary of what shareholders may think of their purchases, try to downplay the aircraft and treat them like they are simply necessary pieces of office equipment, like very large BlackBerries that happen also to fly and offer filet mignon. Besides, for most of the world's top executives and richest people, there are practical and security reasons not to draw too much attention to themselves. The flamboyant American real estate mogul Donald Trump's plane has his name painted on the side of it, but he's an anomaly and perhaps not a very surprising one at that. Moss notes that the Gulfstream's reputation as the ne-plus ultra of global leadership accessories is increasingly an international one. Whereas traditionally only about a quarter of the planes were sold overseas, today the number is approaching 40% and rising fast. At a recent Davos meeting, Moss said he happened to crash a dinner hosted by Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. He introduced himself, and when he explained that he was with Gulfstream, Obasanjo grabbed my hand like this. He clutches my hand. He's a big man, and the next thing you know, I'm not on my knees, but I'm bent over. And for 20 minutes hearing him talk about what a great airplane it was and how much he loved it. The whole dinner just stops. He was so enthusiastic. Davos is the one gathering of potential prospects and clients that takes place around the world each year that Moss says he will not miss. It's not surprising when you consider that Davos is, according to Gulfstream's own records, the one annual event that brings together the largest percentage of its client base. In a typical year, almost 10% of all Gulfstream clients, between 140 and 150 jets and their owners, will fly into Zurich's International Airport, deposit their guests at the General Aviation Terminal, and then wait for them as they are limoed up the mountain to the meeting and back. Gulfstream jets also gather at major international sporting events. 120 aircraft descended on Germany for the 2006 World Cup Soccer Championship, for example. You would have found almost the same number at the airport in Monaco at the time of the Grand Prix. The Geneva Auto Show and the Super Bowl are similarly big destinations, as are the Winter Olympics and the Ryder Cup Golf Championship. You'll also find large concentrations of such aircraft at the small airport in Sun Valley, Idaho, where Allen & Company holds its annual retreat for leaders of the media industry, or at the airport on Hainan Island, where China's Boao Forum takes place. Airport logs offer a clear indicator of a convergence of the powerful. Satellite shots of clusters of G5s and Falcons on the tarmac serve as a sign of economic activity that seldom shows up in newspapers, but one that speaks volumes about markets and power in a rapidly changing world, and about the airborne caravan routes that link the global trade and influence that is at the core of those markets and is the source of much of that power. For private jet travelers, globalization is not an abstract concept, but a day-to-day reality. Travel across oceans or continents is little more than a phone call away. It is commonplace to the point of routine, and it is typically a pleasure instead of a hassle. When these select few, those who consider first class a downgrade, arrive at the airport terminal, they do not wait in lines. They are not buffeted by rude airline personnel or security staff, or delayed by an unending stream of circumstances beyond their control. Bags are whisked to aircraft. Arrival arrangements are made by concierges. And in moments, without passing through security, with less fuss than it takes to enter a typical office building today, they are airborne on flights whose routes they determine, whose menus are catered to their needs and wants. If they don't like turbulence, they direct the pilots to fly around it. If they need to conduct business, most of these aircraft have high-speed internet connections and satellite phone service. They need never leave the office or their comfort zones as they circle the globe. This is worth noting not simply because it is so alien to most of us or so appealing. It is also significant because for the CEOs and heads of state and billionaires and financial executives for whom private jet travel has become a way of life, it changes their worldview. Distance in just an attitude was how one veteran media executive described it. Barriers are removed. From such a vantage point, the world shrinks. Acquaintances on opposite sides of the globe are easily accessible to one another, and circles of friends and colleagues grow more geographically diversified. There are 6 billion people in the world. For half of them, the 3 billion living on less than $2 a day, travel much beyond one's own village in a lifetime is unlikely, or in any case, a rarity. But for a tiny handful, perhaps just 10,000, anywhere, anytime is the reality. For them, the greeting card platitudes of globalization are truths proved by their daily existence. Borders have disappeared, and the world is truly one global community. Within this tiny community, you will find many members of the world's superclass. This emerging group both shapes globalization more than any other group and is shaped by it more than any other group. As such, it offers a test case for the impact of the evolving world without borders, while also offering a glimpse into how it is likely to develop. We ought to look closely at the members of this community, their ambitions and their weaknesses, and the reactions of others with agendas different from their own. We should look closely because we are likely to see hints of the fissures and the tectonic shifts that will remake the world in major ways during our lifetimes and those of our children and grandchildren. Each one is one in a million. As uncommon as, by definition, they are, we are all familiar with the extraordinary among us. In almost every human pursuit, levels of talent and accomplishment seldom ascend in smooth, small increments. In sports, for example, the levels of proficiency are more like the quantum levels of an atom, representing substantial geometrical leaps in capability. The gap between the average amateur and the top amateurs, between the weekend tennis hacker and the ranked college player, for example, is enormous. The gap between top amateurs and average professionals is typically very great as well. The gap between average professionals and those who can play at the top level of their sport year in and year out is yet again exponentially greater. And finally, most strikingly, there is the chasm that separates the top 10 or 20 in any sport and the once-in-a-generation best of the best who appear in ones and twos sprinkled throughout history. Among millions of dedicated, talented, and enthusiastic athletes, an amazingly gifted few set themselves apart, the Michael Jordans and Pelés of the world. The pattern persists from sport to other human pursuits, from art to literature to politics to business. Tolstoy and Dickens, Rothschild and Rockefeller, Mao and Mandela. These are the few who define the direction for their professions and their eras. They are emulated, become beacons, and very often serve as drivers or catalysts for change. In every era, in every pursuit, there are clusters of such individuals atop their fields, some well-known, some invisible, who dominate the worlds around them. Markets reflect and reinforce this quantum structure in society in the way they compensate individuals. Of the hundreds of millions of people in the world who play a sport, for example, only a few thousand can earn a living doing so. Analyzing the salaries of professional baseball, football, and basketball players in the United States, two professors at the University of Chicago, Stephen Kaplan and Joshua Rao, found a striking disparity. In 1995, there were 1,259 athletes who earned more than $500,000 a year, and only 37 who earned more than $5 million annually. Perhaps a surprisingly small number given the headlines those salaries generate. Even accounting for the wage inflation that has affected the top tier of almost every human pursuit during the past decade, the gap remains remarkable and has persisted to the present day. By 2004, the number at the $500,000 level had climbed to just over 2,000, and the number making more than $5 million was still only 369. A tiny fraction when you consider that these athletes are drawn from a pool of talent encompassing hundreds of millions. Each one of this top cadre is literally one in a million, perhaps even more elite than that. Of course, some top athletes are compensated for other qualities, popular appeal, for example, or how they look in a tennis skirt. But it is hard to dispute that the likes of Roger Federer or Tiger Woods, the once-in-a-lifetime greats with truly exceptional skills, deserve to be compensated at a different level if they so dominate a sport and drive public attention to it more than any other athletes. This intensive concentration of recognition and rewards is typical at the top of other fields as well, most often illustrated by compensation levels. This is not true in every area, of course. In fact, modern society exhibits profound defects in the degree to which the best teachers, doctors, and other contributors to human knowledge are not offered the same incentives as those in other fields. Nonetheless, in those areas where compensation is more directly tied to perceived value, the pattern of a few exceeding the many, and even of the very few exceeding the very top performers, repeats. In 1981, University of Chicago professor Sherwin Rosen wrote a landmark paper on the subject titled "The Economics of Superstars," in which he noted that certain economic activities admit extreme concentration of both personal reward and market size among a handful of participants. The trend has since been exacerbated by advances in technology that enhance the visibility of superstars and their ability to better leverage their advantages. Former Treasury Secretary and former President of Harvard University, Lawrence Summers, explained it this way. Once, say 75 years ago, if you were the best concert pianist in the world, and I was also a good concert pianist, we might make roughly the same thing each year because the way we were compensated was playing at the leading concert halls. There was a circuit, and there was room for and demand for a bunch of us to be playing in any given city at any given time. Today, however, the big money is made through recordings, and if I am a recording company, who am I going to invest in signing, producing, and marketing? The number one pianist or the number 15 pianist? And if you are a consumer, why not buy the best recording by the best pianist? So, at the top, technology has helped the superstars perform even better than in the past. The same is true with money managers and others who have a unique skill or quality associated with their reputations. For example, one economist observed, Citibank paid Summers' predecessor, Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, roughly $20 million a year to join them because he could easily repay the investment through just a couple of deals brought in or by a small uptick in stock price due to investor enthusiasm about his hiring. Issues of fairness and burgeoning inequality aside, I will come to those later, it is clear that in field after field, the same pattern follows, with a tiny percentage of superachievers standing apart from the crowd in terms of their compensation. For the purpose of this book, however, I am focused on the group that illustrates this paradigm as it applies to international influence, rather than simply to wealth or achievements in a particular field of endeavor. Roman Abramovich, Russian oligarch, Siberian governor, and owner of the UK's Chelsea Football Club, is one of these elites. 83-year-old Birgit Rausing, worth $11 billion thanks to her husband's Swedish packaging company, Tetra Laval, but living quietly in Switzerland, probably is not. Colombian rock star Shakira is one. All but a tiny handful of the world's most famous movie stars are not. Mukesh Ambani, chief executive of India's Reliance Industries and one of the world's richest men, is certainly one, as is his billionaire brother Anil. Margaret Thatcher, Mikhail Gorbachev, Carlos Menem, and Mahathir bin Mohamed were members of the group but aren't any longer. But former leaders like Lee Kuan Yew, Bill Clinton, and Henry Kissinger, who have maintained their international influence, certainly are. Osama bin Laden is one. Cheri Blair, Tony Blair's accomplished wife, probably was, but now with Blair no longer the British Prime Minister, no longer is. Hundreds of Chinese who are not superclass members today almost certainly will be soon. Only a tiny handful of people living in all of sub-Saharan Africa currently make the list. Each one is one in a million. Of 6 billion people on the planet, there are approximately 6,000 of them. You can name them in every field of human endeavor. Some are easy to spot. Top government leaders from countries that are internationally active, the ones with the kind of political, economic, or resource leverage to influence others. Military leaders from those few dozens of countries with the ability to effectively project force across their borders. The key executives and active shareholders of the world's 2,000 leading corporations. Most of the planet's roughly 1,000 billionaires, dot-com whiz kids, Chinese cowboy capitalists, Arab sheikhs, the giants of Wall Street, London, and other financial capitals. Extraordinarily influential artists, scientists, academics, and writers. Leaders of the world's religions. The defining, distinguishing feature of these individuals is power. Power that, on an ongoing basis, touches millions or billions of people. Not just in one nation, but across borders. They employ people, or move markets, or launch invasions, or inflame passions, or alter deeply held beliefs. You know them when you see them, not just by their ranking on some magazine's top 100 list, but because they so often take on iconic status within their fields. They are the few who have accrued immense influence by virtue of talent, work, fortune, or some combination of the three. Sometimes their power is associated with their own personal financial resources. Sometimes it is associated with a political or a religious following they have built up over a lifetime. More often than not, it is associated with an institutional role they play, such as being a chief executive, a chief investment officer, or a military chief of staff. Frequently, power flows from being in the right place in the right time. Sometimes it flows not from character, but from character flaws, ruthlessness, monomaniacal commitment to a single idea, or greed. It is not difficult to accept that, given his or her ability to launch a war without congressional approval, the President of the United States has sufficient power to change millions or billions of lives across borders. So too do the heads of state whose decisions might directly impact other nations in terms of trade, or alliances, or conflict, or even indirectly by causing refugee flows or environmental changes. Senior cabinet ministers in foreign and defense affairs, who have the ability to shape diplomacy or command military movements worldwide, have a similar kind of power. At one time, many central bank governors were important members of this group, but as the number of viable international currencies has shrunk, the number of these individuals on the list has dwindled. Similarly, leading an NGO that can alter political debates in scores of countries constitutes international influence. The Pope is the spiritual leader of a billion Catholics. It is not hard to see how he qualifies. In addition to its most visible members, this elite includes some who are less easy to identify. Some of these seek out the shadows. Others are slowly emerging from them. These include leaders of terrorist organizations and the masters of organized crime families, from Hong Kong triads to Russian mobsters. The faceless criminals who direct the world's illegal trade in drugs, arms, counterfeit goods, and human beings are also among the members of the shadow elite. The corporate side of the superclass. Of all the different types of individuals who make up the global superclass, the single largest group is leaders in business and finance. There are several reasons for this. For one thing, their power is not circumscribed by national borders, and increasingly extends far beyond them. The rise of transnational corporations and financial institutions has driven globalization, and such businesses are now the largest and most significant transnational actors. There are, according to conservative estimates, more than 1,500 with annual sales or assets in excess of $5 billion. The individuals in charge of these corporate giants have truly global reach. In contrast, the power of national political leaders originates within the borders of their country, and only those countries with meaningful economic ties beyond those borders, or countries that have sufficient resources to project force or mobilize the opinion of other nations, have leaders who can be counted among members of the global superclass. In fact, one of the most important phenomena of the global era is the rise of corporations to economic and social roles that are sometimes equal to or larger than those of states, and that are often divorced from the interests of states. How can you compare the power of companies to the power of countries? In 2007, for example, global GDP was estimated to be $47 trillion. That same year, the top 250 companies in the world had combined sales in excess of $14.87 trillion, equivalent to nearly a third of the global GDP, and an amount exceeding the GDP of the United States or the European Union, $13.20 trillion and $13.74 trillion, respectively. Just the top 100 companies had sales worth over $9.72 trillion, and the combined sales of the top five, Walmart, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, BP, and General Motors, was nearly $1.5 trillion, larger than the GDP of all but seven countries. Although imperfect, direct corporation-to-country comparisons of sales versus GDP provide some striking illustrations in terms of economic clout. ExxonMobil is bigger than Saudi Arabia, the world's 25th largest economy. Walmart ranks between Indonesia and Poland, and General Motors tops Thailand. Indeed, given the scope of influence wielded by these companies, their potential effect on other industries and companies, their global networks of employees and shareholders, you might argue that they are even more powerful than countries of comparable size. After all, companies determine compensation and work schedules, where employees work, and what their benefits are. While government laws guide these decisions, today's companies have the option of relocating their operations and thereby redirecting investment and activity to locations where such obligations are less burdensome. Furthermore, large companies represent large blocks of people, people with political power interested in the preservation of opportunities within their organizations. They also direct resources toward lobbying, supporting politicians, presenting media campaigns to advance their views, and shaping the public debate nationally and internationally. And companies often work together on issues where their interests align, magnifying their power and extending their reach. For purely illustrative purposes, take all entities with sales or GDP in excess of $50 billion. One would be hard-pressed to argue that these are not among the most powerful economic units in the world. Remarkably, of this group, 166 in total at the time of writing this, only 60 are countries, and 106, a substantial majority, are companies. Of course, it is an imperfect comparison. Corporate and national governance structures and reasons for existence are entirely different. GDP is also a measure of value added, whereas sales are not. Also, national government budgets, the money states can spend, are only a fraction of GDP. and one set is linked to national interests, while the other is driven by the interests of the major shareholders and the chief executives and the board members who work for them. What is clear, however, is that the individuals running big corporations have extraordinary power and resources. Who they are, where they come from, and what issues are important to them thereby become important issues. It is significant, for example, that of the 106 mega companies cited above, 91 are based on one side of the Atlantic or the other, 53 are based in Europe, and 38 are in the United States. 8 are in Japan. Surely this has an effect on how large business groups and political entities that depend on those large business groups for support set their priorities. Look at the campaign contribution figures of major political candidates in the United States, and you will see that the most successful candidates depend on the ability of networks within companies and industries to raise the mega amounts they need. In Tokyo, in Brussels, in New York, and elsewhere, businesses not only bear the weight of responsibility for funding lobbying efforts, but they also create the environment into which government officials go to work before or after public service. They remain the path to wealth, another source of influence. It is also worth noting how this geographic distribution will likely shift in the future with the rise of China, India, and other emerging powers, and contemplating what it may mean when more and more of the companies exerting this influence are trans-Pacific rather than transatlantic in origin. Although no measure perfectly conveys the scope of the influence of the world's largest corporations, viewed from any perspective, it is considerable. The world's 2,000 largest corporations at the time of this writing collectively account for $27 trillion in annual sales and $103 trillion in assets. For a comparison, the total market value of the assets traded in global capital markets is estimated by McKinsey at $140 trillion. In terms of manpower, these companies employ more than 70 million workers worldwide. If each of these employees has just 4 dependents, that would mean these companies directly sustain 350 million lives. But in fact, they sustain several times that by virtue of the jobs that they create through trade with other companies. Thus, the decisions of a few thousand individuals, board members, and top management of these companies directly impact the lives of perhaps a billion or more people in the world. Their actions determine job creation or cuts, work conditions and environmental standards, which local politicians are supported and which are undermined. Furthermore, with 3 to 4 billion people struggling to make ends meet in the world, the community of those dependent on the decisions of that handful of senior decision makers represents perhaps half, and almost certainly more, of the well-employed on the planet. The rise of companies to a position of such relative power, and the consequent rise in importance of their leadership, is a fairly new phenomenon. Major companies have been important since the days of the British East India Company and the Hudson's Bay Company, engines of the mercantile greatness of Imperial Britain, but nowhere near the presence in the global economy that they are today. Even a quarter century ago, their share was significantly smaller. In 1983, the top 500 companies had revenues equal to 15% of global GDP. Today, that has almost doubled to nearly 30%. Or, as another metric of growing influence and global scope, consider the increase in the number of international subsidiaries of global corporations. In 1962, the 100 largest corporations in the world had 1,288 foreign subsidiaries. By 1998, the top 100 had more than 10,000 such subsidiaries. Siemens, a German engineering conglomerate and the world's 22nd largest company in terms of sales, has operations in more than 190 companies worldwide. Hewlett-Packard, ranked 24th, operates in 170. The power within the global financial community is extraordinarily concentrated. Not only do markets like the United States, which has $50 trillion in assets, and Europe, nearly $30 trillion, dominate the $140 trillion pool of global capital markets, but individual institutions dominate within those markets. According to Forbes, there were 21 banks and other financial institutions managing assets of at least $1 trillion in 2007. The top 50 financial institutions combined account for $48.5 trillion in assets, more than a third of the global total. The top 100 account for more than two-fifths, $60.4 trillion. To give you a further sense of how similar concentrations of control carry over into the realm of individual investors, the richest 10% of Americans owned nearly 85% of all stock in 2001, with the richest 1% of Americans controlling one-third of America's total wealth. It should be unnecessary to note that those who control the greatest concentrations of wealth and those whose wealth takes the form of shareholder equity also therefore have great clout within the corporations whose influence is so great. Shareholder votes determine the fate of boards and managers whose decisions impact, in the case of the largest companies, millions of workers, families, customers, and suppliers worldwide. Nowhere is the concentration of wealth more astounding than in the case of hedge funds. In just a few years, hedge funds have grown almost exponentially in economic significance, from controlling $221 billion in 1999 to more than $2 trillion by mid-2007. But more important, given their active trading strategies, for example, making money from small movements in the daily prices of securities, these 10,000 funds are, according to some estimates, responsible for between 30 and 50% of the trading on most major equity and debt markets in which they participate. That means that the individuals controlling these funds' trading activities, along with a handful of other major institutional and professional investors, play the central role in determining the share price of the world's largest companies. Since share price is what chief executives are charged with maximizing, being embraced or rejected by this group determines the fate of the chief executives of most large global enterprises referred to earlier. Some hedge fund managers are even more hands-on than others when it comes to turning their money into influence. For example, hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert has been at the vanguard of activist investment approaches that turn ownership into a transformational tool, as when he bought Kmart, merged it with Sears, fired Sears management, and rolled up his sleeves and started making key marketing and merchandising decisions for the merged retailer. Jobs were cut, and Sears' stock initially rose almost tenfold. What is more, the 300 largest hedge funds control 85% of all hedge fund assets, and the 100 largest control 60% of such assets. Thus, it is only a small fraction, a handful, really, of investors driving investment decisions that in turn are a referendum on the future of an also comparatively small group of top corporate leaders who exert such influence in the world today. So, a picture begins to emerge that suggests that power on the planet is not only concentrated, it is extraordinarily concentrated. There are people who are on top and people who are not. And among those who are on top, the few at the very top have hugely disproportionate influence. Vilfredo Pareto's Enduring Insight, The 80-20 Rule and the Superclass. Another way to think about the allocation of power and resources in the world is to explore the stratification of global society along the lines of the Pareto Principle of Distribution, also known as the 80-20 Rule. Inspired by an observation made by French-Italian economist and sociologist Vilfredo Pareto with reference to unequal income distribution in Italy, what later became known as the Pareto Principle more or less observes that for many phenomena, 20% of the causes are responsible for 80% of the consequences. The corollary for income allocation would state that 20% of a population makes 80% of all income. Pareto may understate matters when it comes to global wealth distribution, but it's close. A 2006 study by United Nations University, UNU Wider, reports that the top 10% of adults worldwide own 85% of global wealth, while the bottom half of the world's population owns barely 1% of the total. Though within that top 10%, a group that requires $61,000 in assets to qualify for entry, a similar stark stratification occurs. While this particular elite controls 85% of global wealth, the top 2% in this group owns half the planet's wealth, and the top 1% possesses around 40%. Each of those in the top 1% owns a minimum of $500,000 in assets. This top 1% of global adults, this group of quasi-millionaires, represents about 40 million people. Within this group, however, according to a 2007 report by Merrill Lynch and Capgemini, there are 9.5 million individuals whose financial assets exceed $1 million. And that group, which a Merrill Lynch study has termed high net worth individuals, HNWIs, controls over $37 trillion in global assets, double what it controlled just 10 years earlier. Interestingly, growth among this group was most rapid in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the Asia-Pacific region, Africa, and the Middle East, due in part to rapidly appreciating emerging markets' asset values. However, within this group of exceptionally fortunate individuals is another group cited earlier, the 1% of them, or roughly 95,000, who each own financial assets in excess of $30 million. These are the UHNWIs, or ultra-high net worth individuals, for a total of $13 trillion. And we know that within this group there is another approximately 1% elite, the world's 1,000 or so billionaires. While making direct comparisons among multiple studies poses some difficulties, a pattern clearly emerges. Within most elites there are higher tiers of elites. Within most concentrations of wealth or power, there are those who represent an even greater concentration. Or to put it another way, when seeking to understand elites, always look for the elite within the elite. Within almost every application of the 80-20 rule, there's another one waiting to be discovered. And oftentimes it turns out that an 80-20 rule understates the case. The reality is that when it comes to the unequal distribution of power, we will often find that within the broader application of the 80-20 rule lies a 90-10 or even sometimes a 99-1 rule waiting to be revealed. Of course, this often stops with a single individual or a small group, but the pattern reappears within almost any community we examine. Or, setting aside the business sector for a moment, consider the power stratification in another arena, the military. Among the world's roughly 200 armies, there are only between 30 and 40 with weapons of mass destruction. There are fewer than 20 with any kind of missile capability, only 9 with nuclear weapons capability, only 6 armies with roughly 500,000 or more troops, only 3 air forces with more than 1,000 planes, and, arguably among these, only one that, thanks to its unequaled technology, presence in space, and financial and material resources, is truly capable today of waging modern global warfare. Despite its recent tactical debacle in Iraq, the U.S. military remains a quantum level above all others. Or consider religion. In the same vein, there are perhaps 4,300 religions in the world today, but fewer than 20 have more than 1 million adherents each, fewer than 8 have more than 100 million, and only 2 have more than 1 billion each, not counting the amalgamation of secular, non-religious, agnostic, atheist individuals, of which there are more than 1 billion. So just 2 identifiable religious groups, Christianity and Islam, writ large, have over 1 billion adherents each. Naturally, leaders within these groups have disproportionate power. Yes, individual leaders' power is fragmented, given the decentralized structures within subgroups, Catholics, Protestants, Sunnis, Shiites, yet it is still substantial. A snapshot of the superclass. Taking into account these concentrations, and recognizing those among the wealthy and powerful whose influence extends in a significant way beyond national borders, it is possible to sketch a picture of the global superclass. Take the top officials of the 120 or so governments that have the ability or any proven inclination to meaningfully impact through design or through calamity on major populations beyond their borders. By this calculus, the nation ranking 157th in GDP, Eritrea, which has periodically waged war with neighboring Ethiopia for years, makes the list, whereas Malta, 129th, under most circumstances probably does not. Add the leaders of the world's most powerful militaries. The key executives from the 2,000 biggest corporations, from the 100 richest financial institutions, and from the 500 or so largest global investment firms. The heads of the biggest NGOs and the leading international institutions, and the spiritual leaders from the religious groups that are largest or whose actions may impact others the most. Be sure to include the most important members of the shadow elites, terrorist leaders and criminal masterminds, the most widely read few from the blogosphere. Then throw in leading thinkers, scientists, academics, and artists who also influence millions across borders. Take them all together and you arrive at a rough membership in the superclass of around 6,000, perhaps a few hundred more. Could you define a group of exceptionally influential individuals that is two or three times that? Yes. Are there even smaller circles of ultra-elites within the superclass? Certainly. Are the lower tiers of elites, the 95,000 ultra-high net worth individuals, for example, or additional senior business executives, important? Of course. But this core group of approximately 6,000 remains as good a definition of the world's most influential international actors as one might want for the purpose of understanding the nascent power structures they comprise and how they shape the lives of each and every one of us. It is a sample large enough to be representative of groups that altered definitions might make several times larger, yet small enough to be manageable for analysis. It is important to remember also that we are not simply describing the inhabitants of what one recent book characterized as Richistan. We are going a step further and limiting our interest only to those who translate their wealth, position, and abilities into the regular application of international power in ways that affect millions of lives. Thus, this is just a small subset of the rich lists, the CEO lists, and the lists of the biggest or best known. What does disproportionate power look like? In searching for the elite within the elite, there are many illustrations of global power that simply can't be disputed or denied. There are awesome, even a little frightening, cases of truly disproportionate power or influence. To give a sense of what such concentrated power looks like, here are a few examples. Carlos Slim Ailu, one of the richest men in the world with over $67 billion, controls 94% of Mexico's telephone landlines and 70% of the country's broadband internet market through the companies he owns. Between 2006 and 2007, his fortune grew by $19 billion, or about $2.2 million an hour, and in 2007 was equivalent to nearly 8% of Mexico's GDP. Through his companies, he has used effective monopoly power and huge political influence to push prices up, such that the average monthly phone bill for a small business in Mexico is 120% higher than that of a similar business in the United States. According to the New York Times, Slim has used his influence over the government to fight off attempts by competitors, including MCI and AT&T, to get a piece of the Mexican market. Now he extends that control regionally and worldwide by hosting an annual meeting of the richest family groups in the Americas, the Fathers and Sons Forum, and through global business holdings, including CompUSA, the Texas-based electronics retailer. Rupert Murdoch controls media outlets that reach hundreds of millions of people around the world. As of 2007, his News Corporation owned Fox Broadcasting Company, 20th Century Fox, HarperCollins, The New York Post, The Weekly Standard, The Wall Street Journal, MySpace, DirecTV, 5 British newspapers, 110 newspapers in Australia, and satellite TV providers throughout Europe and Asia. Because its holdings include internet sites and services, News Corp can reach the vast majority of people in the world with a computer. AOL, Yahoo, MSN, and MySpace, for example, together reach approximately 96% of all internet users in the United States. The President of the United States has ultimate command and control of the U.S. military, the most technically advanced and powerful force in the world. The U.S. military possesses more than 10,000 nuclear warheads, comprises over 2.5 million active and reserve military personnel, and has an active presence in more than 130 countries around the globe. The United States spent more than $630 billion on defense in 2007, more than the rest of the world's defense budgets combined. Edward C. Ned Johnson is, as of this recording, the CEO of Fidelity Investments, the world's largest mutual fund, which accounts for 24% of the global 401k market and over 12% of the world's equity market. It manages more than $3 trillion in financial assets. In terms of influence, consider that Fidelity holds at least 10% of the shares of more than 100 of the United States' largest corporations. The Pope speaks for more than 1 billion Catholics in the world, or about 1/6 of the human population. His edicts have the effect of law on their daily lives, whether pertaining to the so-called Ten Commandments for Drivers, promulgated in 2007 by Pope Benedict's Vatican, or his reassertion that the Catholic Church is the one true Church of Christ, and that other Christian denominations lack the means of salvation. Wu Chao-ling governs the foreign reserves of the People's Bank of China, which amount to more than $1.4 trillion. The bank controls more financial assets than any other single public financial institution in the history of the world, with the total expected to pass $2 trillion by 2010. It has already extended its reach overseas with a $3 billion investment in the New York-based Blackstone Group. Wu also ranked 18th on Forbes' list of the world's most powerful women in 2007, probably an understatement of her global influence. Rex Tillerson oversees ExxonMobil's energy reserves, which span 6 continents and produce nearly twice as much oil and gas every day as all of Kuwait. In 2007, his company earned nearly $40 billion in profits, more than the combined GDP of Yemen and Bahrain, and more than any other company in history. H. Lee Scott, CEO of Walmart, manages a corporate behemoth with annual revenues in 2007 exceeding $350 billion, more than the GDP of all but 22 countries. Its annual sales are 5 times greater than those of Microsoft, and more than those of Ford and General Motors combined. The company is 3 times the size of the entire U.S. domestic airlines industry. Lakshmi Mittal's steel company, ArcelorMittal, is by far the largest in the world, with more than 330,000 employees in 6 countries and factories on 5 continents. It is responsible for more than 1/10 of global steel production, more than 3 times the output of its closest competitor. Mr. Mittal is, as of 2007, the world's 5th richest man, with a net worth of more than $32 billion. what the people who have everything really want. For the members of the superclass, there is a commodity more precious than gold, silver, gems, or oil. It is access. The importance of access flows from the fact that the one thing neither money nor power can buy is time. With limited time and great influence or broad interests, every decision about the allocation of time gathers weight. In speaking to hundreds of CEOs, government leaders, generals, and admirals over the years, the one common complaint I have heard most frequently is frustration with the shackles of time. Given those frustrations, it is only natural that schedules are meted out carefully and that time is shared only with those who can offer the greatest returns. Sometimes such returns are business or financial deals or political inside information. Other times they are status or prestige. In any event, it very often means choosing meetings with others who are highly empowered, who can make decisions directly for themselves, who can mobilize significant resources, and whose status is a validator, a demonstration in itself that the meeting is worth having. There is a broad perception that meetings among elite peers are more useful also because few others can understand the position the leaders are in. Aides close to Bill Clinton reported that over time, he became very close to other leaders like Britain's Tony Blair and Russia's Boris Yeltsin because they were the only people who truly understood the issues he was facing. Unlike his staff and those around him, who for the most part depended on his approval for their jobs, these few men and women emerged as valued peers and sometimes, as in Blair's case, confidants. Access and exclusivity go hand in hand, and many aspects of the superclass lifestyle speak to both. Flying in private aircraft, for example, saves precious time and enables small, private meetings to take place in an exclusive setting. It limits access and offers an assurance of exclusivity among those present. Look elsewhere in the lives of the superclass, and you will see similar use of the twin tools of access and exclusivity. Visit the office of Indra Nooyi, the CEO of Pepsi, at the company's sprawling offices in Purchase, New York. Although the design of the headquarters is open and light, with sculpture gardens decorating the many acres of manicured grounds, Nooyi's wood-paneled office is located on the executive floor, the farthest from the entrance to the suite, accessible only through the office of a secretary. Everyone is polite and hospitable, but the message to visitors is clear. Surrounded by great windows and views of the parkland setting, Nooyi's office feels like an inner sanctum. Some offices are much more imperial in nature and isolate their elite occupants even more. Often one must travel down long halls and pass through multiple checkpoints, secretarial or security or both, as was the case for the chairman of Daewoo Industries in Seoul, Korea, before he fled the country to avoid prosecution. The chairman's penthouse surroundings were accessible only via private elevator, perched high atop a hotel he owned, and comprised dozens of rooms full of ancient Asian art. Political leaders often have even more ceremonial offices, settings that emphasize power as well as exclusivity, whether it is in the cavernous ceremonial meeting chambers in the Great Hall of the People on Tiananmen Square in China, or the Casa Civil, the presidential palace in Brasilia, where uniformed guards stand at either side of an entry hall that is the entire open-air first floor of the building. Similarly, participation in high-level meetings, or eating in the best restaurants, or staying in prohibitively high-end hotels or resorts is not simply a luxury or a manifestation of snobbery. It is also an effort to maximize the likelihood of interacting with the people to whom you would wish to grant access and to exclude those to whom you might not wish to grant such access. The same is true about choosing to live or vacation in exclusive settings. A concentration of others with power and wealth increases the likelihood that not only will you interact with such neighbors, but also that the environment in which you live will be able to support the special needs of such people and have the tax base to provide essential services, such as security, that might not be available elsewhere, and so on. For this reason, it is not so surprising to find a single street in London, such as Kensington Palace Gardens, which has become one of the showcase addresses of the global superclass. There you will find Lakshmi Mittal living in a house for which he paid £57 million in 2004. The house was once owned by Baron de Ruyter, a representative of the superclass of an earlier era. Nearby you will find not only embassies of 10 countries, but also homes belonging to the Saudi royal family, the Sultan of Brunei, UK real estate mogul Jonathan Hunt, and another poster boy for the global superclass, Len Blavatnik, who made his billions in Russian oil and aluminum. Few cities in the world are so attractive to members of the global superclass as London, given its cosmopolitan nature, its links to every corner of the world, its tax laws, the concentration of others of similar profile and needs, and the infrastructure to meet those needs. As an enclave of the super-rich, its Asian doppelganger might be Hong Kong, with its lavish Peak neighborhood that is home to 3 of the 4 most expensive houses in the continent. Paris, Dubai, Shanghai, Moscow, Mumbai, Tokyo all have their special neighborhoods for the super-rich. Others can be found in resort communities along the Côte d'Azur in France, in the Hamptons on Long Island, or in West Palm Beach in Florida.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.